Our third case for this morning is United States against Arellano. And we will hear from Mr. Gore.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. John Gore, appointed counsel for appellant Faustino Arellano. Mr. Arellano's conviction should be set aside because they rest on unconstitutionally obtained, inadmissible, and insufficient evidence. First, the district court erred when it admitted into evidence a cell phone discovered through a warrantless, non-emergency, nighttime search of a home that was supported only by the putative consent of an individual who had submitted to the agent's authority, was unlawfully detained, and was under duress.
So is it your position that once the district court finds that Mr. Avila is unlawfully detained, then any consent he later gives is automatically coerced, or is it a more nuanced position?
In this case. In other cases, there might be nuances that might change the analysis, but...
But do I take that then it's not a per se rule? It's not like you find that somebody's detained and then it's impossible to have voluntary consent. The district judge says he doesn't think that's the rule, and so.
That's correct. This court has held that an unlawful seizure renders a resulting consent presumptively invalid and involuntary, and that there may be circumstances where the taint of the illegal seizure is attenuated by intervening circumstances, such as the passage of time. But there was no passage of time here because the seizure was ongoing at the time Mr. Avila voiced the putative consent.
What is the burden of proof? Once we have a finding, as we do here from the district judge, that Mr. Avila is seized, who has the burden of proof to show voluntariness?
The burden of proof to show voluntariness always rests with the government. The government bears that burden to show that. And in this case, once an illegal seizure has taken place, the government then bears the burden to show that intervening circumstances have attenuated the taint of that illegal seizure. And as I was saying just a moment ago, the intervening circumstances here did not demonstrate an attenuation of the taint. The seizure was ongoing when the putative consent was voiced. The only intervening circumstance of note was that six or seven other agents had entered into the home and begun conducting a protective sweep. And the agent's actions obviously had a quality of purposefulness because they persisted for an hour in the knocking and yelling and screaming at the house and refusing to leave. So for all of those reasons, there was no attenuation of the taint here, and Mr. Avila's consent was presumptively and in this case conclusively invalid.
Now, in terms of our standard of review, are you proceeding on the basis that we're reviewing de novo, reviewing for clear error when we look at the voluntariness of the consent?
The standard of review in this case is de novo for a couple of reasons. First of all, there isn't really any dispute about the underlying facts as to what happened. The evidence in the record came from the government's agents. There was no testimony by the defense with respect to the lead-up to this interaction between Mr. Avila and Agent Fergus. And we haven't disputed any of those underlying facts, what I'll call the narrative facts of what actually happened. Moreover, so what we're dealing with here is the district court's misapplication of rules of law to those undisputed facts. That would trigger a de novo standard, both conventionally and under this court's voluntariness cases. Moreover, to the extent there is some kind of factual dispute here, which we don't necessarily believe there is, but if the ultimate question of voluntariness is a factual question, we again believe that that should be reviewed de novo. The government actually took that position below before the district court. I cite, Your Honor, to docket entry 76, page 2, where the government advised the district court that because the only evidence came from government agents, this court's review would be de novo. That position is consistent with the 11th Circuit's decision in Tovar Rico, which we've relied on in our briefs, where the court applied a de novo standard of review for that very reason. And more broadly, this court has an independent obligation in voluntariness cases to review the record and to make a determination about voluntariness.
So let me ask you, the big question, which is why this cell phone is, in fact, so pivotal. It's not really the only evidence. We have conversations that involve Mr. Arellano. We have Mr. Arellano interacting with other people in this drug business. I mean, why is this so critical?
So the government obviously views it as critical because the government's waived any harmless error argument. It didn't make a harmless error argument in its brief.
Yeah, but I'm asking with good reason. About harmless error. So
I appreciate
we
that.
We can consider harmlessness even if the government doesn't argue it, can't we?
That is correct, Your Honor. In certain
the data from this phone went into evidence another way, didn't it, in terms of calls that were made? Didn't they offer the phone records that showed various calls that
They did. They offered both wiretaps involving the phone
right.
of Mr. Villalobos, and then there were other records, GPS records that tracked the phone to various locations.
Right, and phone records about a call to Mexico and so forth.
Correct. There were no wiretaps.
It wasn't as though they just opened up the phone and put that data into the record, correct?
That's correct. But the government did make a big show of the phone at trial, made it a central feature of the case, and insisted that it be sent back to the jury. It was the only physical evidence that the government had against Mr. Arellano and made a big show of it.
The voice identification, right, wasn't it the interpreter or somebody who had listened to the tapes, and then they get Mr. Arellano to talk into the phone, and the person says, yeah, it's the same guy. So we have that. We have it's hot here.
The voice identification was actually excluded.
Oh, that was
that was the Miranda violation, which took place in the same episode as the unconstitutional search.
The conversation about it's not possible to work, the only thing to do is wait, it's a little hot, all those things do come in?
Those conversations still came in, yes, Your Honor. And would not be affected by what we're talking about here, which is exclusion of the cell phone. So we've asked this court to follow three rules. There are three errors in the district court's analysis here on the voluntariness of consent. One is the illegal seizure point, which we've touched on briefly. The district court didn't address this question. This court has left the question open, but other courts have held that an individual cannot be seized within his own home absent either a warrant or probable cause coupled with exigent circumstances. And that rule flows from the Supreme Court's decision in Payton, where the Supreme Court held that officers can't even enter a home without a warrant or exigent circumstances. There was no warrant in this case. The agents, in fact, abandoned their effort to secure a warrant, and there were no exigent circumstances.
They had a lot of suspicion about this house, though, didn't they, based on calls they'd intercepted about the movement of heroin and about seeing Villalobos' car at that location, GPS data tracking, I think it was Arellano's, to that particular house, and some registration of Moreno's vehicles at that location, right?
They did have other information pointing to that particular house.
So there was, would you agree there was at least reasonable suspicion that there might be criminal activity afoot there?
No, we don't agree with that, and we also think that's irrelevant. Let me explain. The evidence that the information the government had centered on the car, this green Honda that had been associated with Mr. Villalobos and his drug activities. That car was parked in a detached garage. It was not parked in a garage that was part of the house. It was not parked anywhere inside the house, for example. And the agents did not observe anyone removing anything from the garage or from the car and taking it into the house. So there may have been reasonable suspicion or perhaps more with respect to the detached garage, but that doesn't really get to the question about the house. For the house, the information they had was that Mr. Arellano's cell phone was there, that they thought this Mr. Moreno individual might be there. It turned out to be incorrect. He had registered cars to the address but wasn't there that night. And they had observed other individuals moving from the detached garage into the house. So whether or not that adds up to reasonable suspicion, our position is that it doesn't. But even if it does with respect to the house, that's insufficient to justify the seizure of Mr. Avila, which requires either a warrant or probable cause coupled with exigent circumstances.
Not to stop him, though. Not for a Terry stop.
Well, but I think that gets to the question of whether a Terry stop can be done inside a home like that, whether a seizure within a home requires a warrant or probable cause coupled with exigent circumstances. As I mentioned, this court in Johnson left that question open. The Sixth Circuit has resolved it.
But he came to the door and, upon being asked, said, you can come in, didn't he?
That's correct. And the government would
it's not like they kicked the door in and grabbed him.
Well, the government would have the court believe that that's sufficient. The government wants to isolate that short, few-moment, face-to-face interaction with
And at that moment, the district court finds he's been seized.
Correct.
So we have a factual finding for whatever we may choose to, you know, make it worth, from the district court that Mr. Avila is seized at the moment he gives his consent. The government says things like, well, he was calm, and I'm not sure whether, other than being calm, what they rely on to support the idea that the consent is voluntary, but at least that.
That's largely what the government relies on, which is insufficient and inadequate under Tovar Rico. Moreover, the government's trying to isolate these few moments of this face-to-face interaction between Agent Ferguson and Mr. Avila. They want the court to ignore everything that led up to that, which was this hour of surrounding the house, knocking on the doors and windows, screaming and yelling, and refusing to leave.
The district judge found that the consent was voluntary, correct?
Correct.
And that's a fact-finding, isn't it?
Chief Judge Wood and I were touching on that earlier. The standard review should be de novo because there's no dispute about what the underlying narrative facts are, and the only dispute is about the application of law to those facts. Moreover, because the only evidence came from government agents, the standard review is de novo, even to the extent the voluntariness question is one of fact.
The court has said questions like consent, while you defer to the underlying facts because they implicate constitutional rights, have a more aggressive standard of appellate review.
That's correct.
Thinking of Ornelas, for example.
That's correct, Your Honor. And more to the point, the district court also found that Mr. Avila opened the door only in submission to the agent's authority. Mm-hmm. And the Supreme Court has made clear that consent that results merely from a submission to authority is involuntary and invalid. The 11th Circuit in Tovar Rico and the 8th Circuit in Connor both extended that principle to hold that an individual who opens the door to a dwelling place in submission to authority cannot be deemed to have consented to the entry and seizure.
Do we actually know whether he stepped across the threshold or whether he stayed inside the threshold?
Are we talking about Agent Fergus right now?
No, I'm talking about Mr. Avila.
Mr. Avila. So Mr. Avila opened the door. There was a door and a screen door that he opened. And I think the record's not clear. He may have stepped across the threshold when he opened the door. Agent Fergus at that point was standing on the front lawn of the house and walked in and asked if he could come in. He walked in.
Pretty immediately, the other seven people come in and start to secure the place, right?
Correct. And that's also a very important fact, because by the time the district court found that by the time Mr. Avila had voiced his consent, six or seven other agents had come into the house and begun conducting a protective sweep, which again only underscores that these were circumstances in which the consent could not have been voluntary because agents were already in the house looking around. And even if this court were to apply the five-factor test from Bustamante, those factors indicate, again, and demonstrate that Mr. Avila's consent was involuntary. In the first place, he was never advised of his rights. Agent Fergus even testified that he had a consent form in his car that he didn't retrieve, didn't review with Mr. Avila, and didn't have Mr. Avila sign. Second, as the district court concluded, Mr. Avila had been seized within his own home. Third, that seizure had lasted for a full hour, perhaps even longer, because agents had been outside even before
the
knocking.
Was that his finding, that he'd been seized as of the time they started that hour-long knocking?
That may not have been the exact finding, Your Honor. There was a finding that he had been seized at least by the time that he opened the door. So the seizure had been going on for at least some period of time. And Mr. Avila didn't voice his consent immediately. He waited until there had been repeated requests from the agents before he voiced his consent. And the district court found that a reasonable person in his circumstances would not have felt free to ignore the agents and the officers. So for all of these reasons, Mr. Avila's consent was invalid, and the district court erred when it admitted the cell phone into evidence. I'd like to reserve time for rebuttal.
You can reserve a minute. You're getting low. But
unless the court has any other questions.
We can wait, I think.
Thank you.
Mr. Lee.
May it please the court. My name is Stephen Lee on behalf of the United States. The district court here did not clearly err in finding, based on the totality of circumstances, that Mr. Avila provided voluntary consent for agents to enter his home and to search his home.
So I'm not sure. So as I've been discussing, I don't think the clear error standard applies to a finding like the ultimate finding of consent. And my concern with the government's position here has to do with the allocation of the burden of proof, which is, in any event, a legal issue. what the district judge says, he says, based on the testimony of Agent Fergus and in the absence of any countervailing testimony, I can't say that the consent that the man gave was anything other than voluntary. But then he goes on to say, it's true that when the man gave consent to search, that other agents had already entered and were looking around, and so a reasonable argument could be made that the man was simply submitting to authority in this situation. And that all reads to me like he thinks that the burden was on, ultimately, of course, Mr. Arellano, to show that there was a lack of voluntariness. And I believe that's wrong as a matter of law. If it's in equipoise, the government has the burden of proof.
I think in terms of the burden of proof, I believe it is on the government
it
to prove the totality of the circumstances. I think actually in terms of that part of the district court's findings, I don't think he shifted the burden onto the defendant, and I think he was actually less clear. In his findings, he actually talks about how it was unclear as to the timing of Mr. Avila's consent to enter and search compared to when Agent Ostro goes in.
I don't know where you get that. He says it's true that when the man gave consent to search that other agents had already entered and were looking around. That doesn't say they didn't already enter and were looking around. So...
In terms of the judge's findings, he actually says it's possible that Mr. Avila consented even before the sweep started. That's on page 16 of the transcript for the October 12th hearing in which the district court made its findings. So he goes on to say, the district court said, it's possible...
He says both things, which is what is troublesome to me. I'm looking at page 21 of the appendix, page 14 of the transcript. Other agents come in to perform the sweep, but it's lines 21, 22, 23, where he's saying when the man gave consent, other agents had already entered. And then that's when he makes the submitting to authority argument. And certainly submitting to authority is not a voluntary consent. That's pretty clear. Then he relies on these two unpublished decisions, Rico Beltran and Gutierrez, and he doesn't really engage with Tovar Rico.
The circumstances in Tovar Rico are distinguishable from this case. And first, if I may, I point out that the district court did state here on page 21 of the defense appendix that the government proved by preponderance of the evidence that the consent was voluntary, both to enter the house and to search the house. I don't believe the district court did shift the burden to the defendant. Now, I think what he's saying here is that he's distinguishing between the consent to enter the house versus the consent to search. And I think the record is unclear, and I think the agent's testimony was a little unclear as to the exact precise timing, given that it's coming from two different witnesses. The Tovar Rico case, that involved a situation where the police knocked loudly at the door, requested permission to enter. Tovar Rico opened the door, and the officers entered quickly with the guns drawn. The police did a sweep then, and then, after the sweep was done, asked Tovar Rico for consent. Tovar Rico basically raised the question, rhetorical question, like, why are you asking me for consent? You've already searched the house, so why are you asking me? And then the police told him
that... But they told him in Tovar Rico that he had a right to refuse. Nobody ever tells Mr. Avila that he has a right to refuse. They just... I envision this all happening from the description very quickly. The door opens. There's an exchange between Fergus and Avila. The other guys are just coming in and sweeping around. There are no exigent circumstances. They've been pounding on the house for an hour. They wouldn't have done that if they'd been afraid that somebody was flushing heroin down the toilet or otherwise. Evidence of finding people living, the usual exigent circumstances. I think it's very troublesome.
In the Tovar Rico case, it's true to the Tovar Rico case. In this case, they just had knocked on the door and then allowed people to come out. Then it stopped. And then at that time, the agents were not at the door of the house, but Mr. Avila decided to open the door. And during that hour, Mr. Avila and the other occupants of the house, they did not respond to the knocking on the door. there was an indication that someone in the house called local police to find out what was going on.
Right, but the district judge, who's turning the facts on? The district judge finds against you on this. You're trying to do this to go. Everybody was home fine inside the house. This one was shouting and shouting and screaming and going on. The district judge says, no, that is why at the moment Mr. Abdul is in the house. He is the, he knows it is. He knows where to go. He can't lift up your house. That's why all my doors are in some other place.
And we don't dispute that. The district court found the district found that Mr. Abdul was seized at the time. But the district court did not find that he was illegally seized. I think that's the key distinction between what happened in some of the cases cited by the defendant and what happened here. The district court was not asked to review whether the seizure of Mr. Abdul was illegal at the time. There was no argument about that before the district court. So, at the time that Mr. Abdul was seized, there was at least reason to suspicion that criminal activity was afoot. Basically, as recounted, the agents had knowledge of a wiretap, which indicated that a large amount of heroin had been moved from Mr. Abdul's fire stash house to a house in Harvard. They also saw that defendants were in contact with Mr. Abdul's home.
Right, no, I remember all that part. What I'm looking at is funny. I find the famous clip here at the bottom of the page. When the man opened the door, he was submitting to the officer's show of authority. That's quoted from Garrett, who said the same thing was true here. As in Garrett, he wouldn't have felt free to ignore the officers and continue about his business. And then he goes on to say, I think this is driven by all the facts, and he seems to have been sure. And that's where it's problematic. I think the seizure, nobody gets Mr. Abdul has done anything wrong.
I think that
the truth of the seizure goal, it's a very, it's a show of authority that it's working for. If you say yes, you can come in. Because he's committing to a show of authority, that's a bad concern.
At the time, the district court did not find simply that Mr. Wheeler, that was not the only thing that the district court considered. The district court considered the fact that Mr. Wheeler was seized. As you say, there was no finding that the seizure was illegal at that point. The district court then went on to consider the testimony about the encounter. I thought the district court asked the questions of Mr. Diehl as a non-threatening manner, and that Mr. Diehl consented immediately, and that the district court
immediately, how do we know immediacy means I'm doing this voluntarily versus immediacy means you beat me, I don't have any choice, I'm going to submit to your request, and otherwise you're just going to be counseled against you.
Mr. Abdul, I think that goes a little bit to, again, the totality of circumstances. Mr. Abdul did not simply open the door when police first knocked on the door. He was aware that he did not have to open the door, and he exercised that right from out, and he chose to open the door at a time when agents were not knocking on the door, when they had stopped.
But how do you read that? Somebody's been knocking on your house all night, and it's just simply just simply just realistic acquiescence.
Well, that was an argument that was future focused and rejected and made me apply to that apologize based on all the testimony about what actually happened.
I'm not sure why you just apologize.
That may have been oversight on the government's part. In terms of the phone, it was a small part of the overall case. The few agents
were found. Could you distinguish answering that question between the conspiracy count and the two counts of use of the
I think that they get a different, I think it goes either way. Basically, even without the admission of the phone, the defendant had used that phone in having a conversation with Mr. Glover. The phone was described in Mr. Miriam's name, and that information was obtained from the phone company and the rest of the company's cell phone location. The cell site data for that phone
show that the phone had been at the defendant's home in Georgia, description information, even before the phone was at the I'm not sure about the description information. If the agents had it in time, I don't know if they were actually aware when having this going on. I'm not sure if they were focused on that particular name. But they did have GPS information, and the driving location was still was not tested by whether the phone itself was but the cell site data, the phone description, all that information tied the defendant to the telephone call. Which presented and which was a result of the defendant's evidence showing that the defendant participated in the conspiracy with the local and if he was a defendant, he had used his health care in further the defendant's case. I want to further questions. The government ends by asking if you have further questions.
All right, thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Ford?
Just a quick point, Your Honor. The government's referred to the Rico Beltran and Gutierrez cases as the fourth of the unpublished proceedings. Neither one involved a finding that there's been a submission to authority. Neither one involved a finding that there's been a seizure of the defendant. Second, Hobart Rico, the legal manager, when the senior people in this case had told an individual to open the door to his home, that a submission to authority cannot be deemed to have consented to the increase in search. The fact that they were against in Puerto Rico is not necessary here. Puerto Rico didn't involve many of the serious facts that we have here, including the hour-long surrounding of the house, knocking the room.
This is that irrelevant seizure, not seizure.
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor. And that's what the
fact of the case
is. I think that the surrounding of the home and seizing of the home and seizing the occupants within the home is a district court. For two reasons. First of all, reasonable suspicion would not have been sufficient to see permission of my home. The government needed to see what I want or call it.
Who's your
home?
Who's your
home? I don't know that he was placed under a formal arrest or taken to a station house or if the evidence is clear on that. It's not in the record. The record is clear, however, that he was seized. The district court fast-forwarded to the conclusion that seizure didn't take his consent for reasons he stated in the knowledge of the officer. It also did do so in the act of seizure.
Thank you. And we appreciate very much, Mr. Bowie, taking the appointment in this case.